Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It.
Here we are, episode number 58, special COVID-19 edition number 6 and counting. Friday, April 17th, I am coming to you from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, which still looks eerily like my den as I shelter in place. I hope you are staying safe, protecting yourself and others.
Mayday, 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 mayday.
Mayday, mayday. All week, Trump has been ponderously pondering whether to open up the economy for business on May 1st. When and how to open up the economy. President Donald John Trump billed it as his biggest decision of his life. Well, it's no surprise that we'll all be paying the bill for what turns out to be a big non-decision as he passed the buck to the states after asserting total authority. When asked what metrics he would use to make such a huge decision, he pointed to his head. And that's what we got. A shell of a plan, a whole lot of nothing, virtually nothing measurable, no national testing strategy, no wartime effort to ramp up contact tracing, but hey, mission accomplished. The Don has insulated himself from the cascading disaster that is this pandemic by pushing the blame onto governors, and of course China, and of course the World Health Organization. Good news, there will be enough blame for everyone. Well, last week I did a deep dive into the White House's favorite model, which, by the way, has proven day by day to be less accurate. But we would be fools to think that our national response is being led by a model. Certainly not a model president. It looks like states and local communities will have to continue patching together a national response. In good news, some states are partnering with neighboring states to coordinate their responses. This is happening on the coast and in the Midwest. Unfortunately, many states, or more precisely, many red states, look like they're going to do it on their own. And as an example of this, from CNN, Florida's governor keeps hitting new lows in the battle against coronavirus. Governor DeSantis declared WWE, yes, professional wrestling, a, quote, essential business in the state, meaning that the organization could run live shows from its facility in Orlando. And also from CNN, Heartland hotspots, a sudden rise in coronavirus cases is hitting rural states without stay-at-home orders. Just as cases are starting to plateau in some big cities and along the coast, the coronavirus is catching fire in rural states across the American heartland, where there has been a small but significant spike this week in cases, playing out amid these outbreaks in a clash between frontier culture that values individual freedom and personal responsibility, and the onerous but necessary restrictions to contain a novel biological threat. The bump in coronavirus cases is most pronounced in states without stay-at-home orders. Oklahoma saw a 53% increase in cases over the past week, according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins University. Over the same time, cases jumped 60% in Arkansas, 74% in Nebraska, and 82% in Iowa. South Dakota saw a whopping 205% spike. And those South Dakota numbers? Also from CNN. One of the largest pork processing facilities in the U.S. is closing until further notice. One of the country's largest pork processing facilities is closing until further notice as employees fall ill with COVID-19. The closure puts the country's meat supply at risk, with the CEO of Smithfield, said the CEO of Smithfield, which operates the plant. It is impossible to keep our grocery stores stocked if our plants are not running, he said. These facility closures will have severe, perhaps disastrous, repercussions for many in the supply chain. The Sioux Falls, South Dakota facility accounts for 4 to 5% of the country's pork production and employs about 3,700 people. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem said during a Saturday news briefing that Smithfield employees accounted for more than half of the active coronavirus cases in the state. About 240 employees are sick, she said, out of roughly 430 active cases in the state. Because of that, she and the mayor of Sioux Falls recommended that Smithfield suspend operations for at least 2 weeks. The problem extends beyond South Dakota. Meat processors in Iowa and Pennsylvania have also shut the doors because of sick employees. Smithfield will maintain some activity in the plant on Tuesday to process its inventory as it prepares to fully shut down, adding that it will compensate employees for the next 2 weeks. Well, my friends, this story is actually a little bit old in this fast-moving epidemic. I think today the news was that there was over 600 people, so these move fast. Doesn't matter where you are, doesn't matter if you're in South Dakota, this virus transmits fast. If we don't protect ourselves from it, it will continue to be a raging epidemic. Okay, and if you're still not convinced that this virus is everywhere, from IB Times, COVID-19 strikes isolated Amazonian tribe as 15-year-old dies of coronavirus. The boy was one of 26,000 Yanomami living in the remote Rehebi village located by the Urucuara River near the border of Brazil and Venezuela. The Yanomami is the largest isolated indigenous tribe in South America. In the past, the Yanomami have had outbreaks of diseases like flu and measles following visits from missionary groups and military agencies. As a remote community, the tribe has no immunity to infectious diseases. The Socio-Environmental Institute said in a statement that illegal miners may have likely spread the virus among the Yanomami. The group claimed that there are over 20,000 illegal miners who can go in and out of their remote territory as there are no control and sanctions.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you, your friends and loved ones, your city, state, your entire nation, suffer from an unprecedented crisis? Then your body politic may be infected with TLTL 2020 virus, also known as the TL20 squared virus. This too little too late 2020 virus has many vague and contradicting symptoms, but it is known to be exacerbated by election years. Do you suffer from exponential anxiety, worldwide depression, and recurring hallucinations of unimpeachable leadership? Don't worry, as the 2020 campaign season heats up, this will all go away. We don't call it a novelty virus for nothing. Hey people, don't look down. Things are looking up. Body bag futures are looking fantastic. This promises to be the best pandemic ever. Incredible things will happen as you save the world by doing nothing but watching TV. But remember, only get your Nothing Burgers from the drive-thru window. Please note, Nothing Burgers will now be referred to as Patriot Burgers. Doing too little has never been easier. Hey, what's the worst? That could happen. This message is brought to you by Cassandra Reproductions, seer of unbelievable futures, and maker of Pickled Posterity, coming too little, too late, to a shuttered store near you. You may now return to your regular programming.
Okay, since we may not be getting much help from the federal level, we might want to ask the question, so how well prepared are we in Lucas County to deal with this pandemic? Well, we had one interesting find this last week. We now have social distancing data from cell phones to give us an idea how well we've been doing. This has been graphed to gauge social distancing by three measures. The U.S. gets a C grade, which means there's a 40 to 55% reduction in average mobility based on the distance traveled, a 60 to 65% reduction in non-essential visits, and a 74 to 82% decrease in encounters density compared to the national baseline. Ohio gets a D minus compared to the C grade of the U.S., and for Ohio, this means that there is a 25 to 40% reduction in average mobility based on the distance traveled, and a 55 to 60% reduction in non-essential visits, and less than 40% of a decrease in encounters density compared to the national baseline prior to the epidemic. Lucas County, that is Toledo, was 6th out of 7 Ohio metropolitan areas in this data rating, beat out only by Mahoning County, Youngstown, which is also, not surprisingly, the only Ohio metropolitan area to beat out Lucas County in rate of identified infections. If you'd like to check out this data for any state or county in the United States, you can do it with this tool. Go to unicast.com/COVID-19, no dash in that. That's unicast, UNACAST. Okay, well, you know what? Wouldn't it be neat if they developed a COVID-19 preparedness index to tell us how ready our county is? Well, this from Stat News. COVID-19 preparedness, how ready is your county? To produce this rating system, Stat partnered with Applied XL and the Center on Rural Innovation to come up with a way to assess every U.S. county's level of preparedness for the COVID-19 pandemic. The map takes into account a number of different factors, including residents' access to care, the risk for severe COVID infections, and a county's overall vulnerability. It also incorporates data from a COVID-19 model that forecasts the impact of the pandemic at the state level to the county level. The overall county preparedness score is an unweighted average from 5 pillars that is scaled from 1 to 100. The model is based on 5 variables. Here we go. The number 1, the number of licensed hospital beds within a 40-minute drive. This was used to estimate the physical capacity of a community as a way to assess how ready hospitals are to handle a surge of cases. The pandemic comes after years of dozens of rural hospital closings. 2, the number of critical care staff within a 40-minute drive, a measure of the human resources. In addition to lacking the health infrastructure of cities, rural areas have fewer specialists, nurses, respiratory therapists, and other healthcare workers who would be needed to handle local outbreaks. 3, the percentage of the population age 65 and older. Older people who contract the coronavirus are much more likely to need medical care and to die from the infection than others. 4, the county score on the Social Vulnerability Index, a ranking from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that measures resiliency to natural disasters and disease outbreaks. The score takes into account such factors as poverty, access to transportation, and housing. 5, data from the University of Washington Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation's COVID-19 model. The developer of the STAT tool used the model's estimates of the ICU bed shortage to assess the severity of the pandemic in each county at a given time and to forecast how bad it could get. The methodology underlying the map does not take into account other important factors such as rates of insurance coverage or the migration of people from cities to rural areas, a movement that centered on places where there are lots of vacation homes. It also does not directly factor in choices of local and state governments or how well-funded local agencies are. So, how does Lucas County fare in all of this? Well, of the 88 counties in Ohio, Lucas is 3rd from the bottom. Unfortunately, Cuyahoga is by far the worst with only a 9 out of 100. Lucas County comes in at 26 with a close 3rd behind Mahoning at 25. And what this breaks down for Lucas County is the physical capacity, which is we got a 16 out of 100. We have only 116 hospital beds per 100,000 residents within a 40-minute drive. And the human resources, we got a 26 out of 100. That is, we have 100 critical staff per 100,000 residents. And the demographics, how many old people, seniors, 65 plus do we have in our population? This was our best score. We got a 76 out of 100. We only have 15% of our population above this age threshold. Then the socioeconomic measure, that social vulnerability scale from the CDC, we got a 40 out of 100. And from the IMHE model about the COVID-19 peak, we got just a little bit less than the median, getting a 46 out of 100 for a composite score of 26. Not that great, but there you have it, folks. Glad to know that somebody's out there trying to get a sense of where counties are. And as you can hear from the story, a lot of this is driven by concerns in the rural areas, which have a lot less healthcare resources generally available to them. But as it looks out, and I'm actually a little surprised by this because we, Ohio as a whole, and even Lucas County, scores fairly well on a lot of healthcare measures as far as like number of providers and hospital institutions and that kind of thing. But by this measure, we ain't doing that well. Well, what about some more truly local information? I've been trying to get some questions answered from the Toledo-Lucas County Health Department. I didn't get any response from my inquiries last week. I was initially blown off this week, but upon two follow-ups, I got a written response to some of my questions. I must admit, this is a kind of a trigger for me. Having been the former health planner many years ago at the Toledo-Lucas County Health Department and an observer of how they have functioned over the last 20 years, and also prior to that when I worked there for about 13 years, not really impressed with the responsiveness to media requests. And just to give you an idea of how I feel when trying to extract information from our local health department, I have for you a dream sequence, or more accurately, a dream nightmare sequence. Thank you for calling your local health department. Press 1 for English. Press 2 for press release ease. Press 3 if you can't understand this message at all. Press 4 for a directory of numbers that won't return your call. Press 5 if your question can wait until the worldwide pandemic is over. Press 6 if your question is so urgent that you will be social distancing 6 feet underground soon. Press 7 if you really like the number 7. If none of these options are satisfying, please pound your hand onto the keypad several times and hope for the best. Okay, the good news I do have to report is that I did get some info from them, which I will report on a little bit later. But now, let's get to some nursing home data. This is from the local news media and the Ohio Department of Health. Now, I didn't get this info from the Toledo-Lucas County Health Department. Apparently, I still have not been added to their media list as requested. So, here we go. There have been 107 infections identified related to 30 nursing homes in Lucas County. This includes both staff and residents. There have been 30 positives in residents among 9 nursing homes. This means that it is likely that infections are present in most, that is, a majority, of nursing homes in Lucas County. Plus, the 107 positives out of a total of 600 or so positives at the time shows how big of a role nursing homes play in our local epidemic. And in a related story, to drive this point home from the Hill, New Jersey officials assume COVID-19 is in most, if not all, nursing homes. New Jersey authorities are making the assumption that COVID-19 is in most, if not all, nursing homes in the state, an official said Monday. Health Commissioner Judith Persichilli announced at a press briefing that 324 of the state's 375 nursing homes have confirmed cases. Less than 2 weeks ago, only 81 of the homes had confirmed cases. We're making the assumption that COVID-19 is in most, if not all, of our nursing homes, she said at the briefing. More than 5,200 residents in these homes have tested positive for the coronavirus, accounting for 10% of the nursing home population. State agencies have reported more than 2,300 nursing homes with at least one coronavirus case across the country, according to data analyzed by USA Today. More than 3,000 people have died in these homes across 37 states. Okay, well, if you break that down, there's actually 15,600 nursing homes in the U.S. approximately. So from what's been reported, and that may be weak and late reporting, as the time of this article a few days ago, over 1 in 8 nursing homes are reporting an infection. And of course, we're seeing it looks like a majority or substantially more in Lucas County. Yikes. Well, It's time to debut a special message brought to you exclusively from Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, with that, I'd like to take a little time to say a word or two about predictions. Certainly in this era of uncertainty, there are a dizzying array of predictions whirling around. But first, like Yogi Berra so notoriously noted, predictions are difficult, especially when they are about the future. Secondly, Yogi Berra, a Hall of Fame baseball coach, has way more insight into the future than our president, whose leadership more resembles Yogi the Bear. As for me, I am way less scared of the uncertainty in this epidemic than I am with the epic denial of those things that we do know with a high level of certainty. Those things we know from a little thing I like to call science. And if there's one thing I know about our response, is that we need to think bigger. Plus, predictions are best made suitable to a proper time frame. And in this case, that is neither 24-hour news cycles, nor days, nor weeks, nor months, nor in quarterly earnings reports, but in fact, the proper time frame is a year or more. Speed is of the essence, and this must necessarily be paired with a long-term framework and planning. I see the greatest risk in our response to this worldwide pandemic is our piecemeal, patchwork, disjointed, and devolved approach, always two steps behind, in what is likely to be an endemic virus for a long time to come. And to get a taste of that thinking big, to look at this article from the New York Times. Lesson from Singapore, why we may need to think bigger. Many experts are beginning to coalesce around a set of benchmarks that could help determine when it might be safe to reopen parts of the country. But even though most areas of the United States are nowhere near achieving the goals necessary to do so, there's been a push to relax social distancing soon. Even more alarming, some experts say even those still not yet achieved goals aren't close to enough, it appears that it may be time to think bigger. These are unprecedented times, and so we need to think on a scale that would previously be considered unimaginable, said Natalie Dean, an assistant professor of biostatistics at the University of Florida. The cautionary tale at the moment is Singapore. For weeks, public health officials have been enviously lauding its response to COVID-19. Singapore officials have been screening and quarantining all travels from outside the country since the beginning of the pandemic. Their contact tracing is second to none. Every time they identify an infection, they commit to determining its origin in 2 hours. They post online where identified infected people work, live, and have spent time so that potential contacts can be identified. They enforce quarantines and isolation of such contacts with criminal charges for those who violate orders. And yet, in the last week, they've put the entire country into lockdown. All migrant workers are confined to their compounds for at least 2 weeks. Citizens may leave their homes, but only to buy food or medicine or to exercise. Anyone who breaks the rules, including spending time with anyone not in their household, can be imprisoned or fined the equivalent of $7,000 U.S. or both. What Singapore was doing, more of that below, dwarfs what most are discussing in the United States. its present circumstances bode poorly for our ability to remain open for a long time. There's just no way we're going to be able to keep most of the country open through the year, said Ezekiel Emanuel, vice provost of the Global Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. If Singapore can't do it, I don't imagine how we think we can. As I have said, this is going to be a roller coaster with multiple waves of opening and partial reclosings necessary. Given the U.S. government's limited and lagging response to date, the idea of a hugely ambitious project may seem implausible, but the cost of another future shutdown is so high that previously unfathomable ideas may be worth considering. Here are a few. Paul Romer, a Nobel-winning economist and NYU professor, proposes that 7% of the population be tested each day. If put on a rotating schedule, that would mean everyone would be tested roughly once every 2 weeks. He argues that even if there are plenty of false negatives, if we are committed to isolating everyone with a positive test, we could keep the vast majority of Americans out and about in normal life. All told, that would mean 150 million tests a week. Editorial note, we've only conducted about 3 million overall during the entire epidemic this far in the United States. Okay, critics will argue that's impossible. We cannot even seem to manage a million a day, let alone a week. They say we lack the materials as well as the reagents for chemical analysis, the delivery infrastructure, and the machines to run so many tests. Mr. Romer is not dissuaded. I've been focused on the single idea my whole career. That just because something is unfamiliar doesn't mean it's impossible, he said. Building interstate highways, scanning every book, going to the moon, these were all outrageous ideas at one time. But if we put enough resources in our minds to it, we are able to make the impossible possible. His plan would rely less on contact tracing and isolation, since everyone would be tested regularly, and this might make infection control easier in many parts of the country. Contact tracing requires significant infrastructure and is hard to do well. We spend something like $700 billion a year to protect us against military threats, he says. We are at greater risk from a biological threat at the moment than any military threat. We should be prepared to spend at least $100 billion a year not only to protect us against the virus, but any potential new viruses that could threaten us in the future. Other ambitious ideas can be found in a plan from the Center for American Progress, authored by Dr. Emanuel and colleagues. Part of the proposal is an enormous information technology monitoring system. It would call for all Americans to download apps to their phones that would monitor where they go and whom they get near, which would allow contact tracing to be done instantaneously. Everyone could sign in electronically before using public transportation, entering large buildings or schools or gatherings in groups above a certain number. They even propose requiring an app to be downloaded in order to receive test results. In an ideal situation, it would run in the background regardless of whether users signed in. If we could do real-time contact tracing in a person's phone and GPS signals and alert people they have been exposed to a COVID-19 positive person, that would greatly ease the containment strategy, he said. Of course, such a system would be considered a large intrusion on privacy, and it's not clear it is politically feasible or even legal. Additionally, not every American has a smartphone. Editorial note, that's a kind of a huge Achilles heel for that. Of course, you could just provide everybody with a smartphone if you're going to have that ambitious of an approach. Okay, back to the article. Meredith Matoni, scientific director of Policy Lab and an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, says we may need to get away from testing to more grassroots approaches. A more realistic and useful approach would focus much more on surveillance, monitoring communities more than individuals, she said. As detailed in a Policy Lab policy review, such surveillance could relax our need for active testing. It would be more reliant on passive systems, like monitoring electronic medical records or traditional infection monitoring systems to pick up signals of outbreaks, like increased visits to doctors or emergency rooms for respiratory illnesses. Surveillance could also involve a participatory approach, like asking patients to be tested before clinic visits or to enter symptoms on web-based tracking platforms or to regularly check their temperatures at home. Thermometers would be ubiquitous and could even be linked to the internet for reminders and reporting. If such systems work well, we don't need to capture an entire population to detect a signal. We could identify hotspots telling us where to do more focused testing. Such testing could even be done by pooled samples. In such an approach, areas would have their individual samples combined together for testing, which saves resources. If it's clear, everyone is safe. If an infection is found, then, again, more focused testing could be done on the individuals in the pool. The Policy Lab review also highlights the benefits of improving workplace safety, especially in high-risk areas like childcare, school, and healthcare environments. To make infection control more robust and surveillance easier to accomplish. Not everyone thinks we need to aim quite that high. Caitlin Rivers, an author of a recent American Enterprise Institute report on reopening a nation, and an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, said, while Singapore is adding in some community mitigation measures, they've been able to successfully keep levels of infection under control for months, and they're still only seeing 100 or 200 infections a day, which is far fewer than we are. A case-based approach is still the best way to move forward. And while it's possible that some areas may have to revert to staying home, I don't think that's inevitable. Of course, we should still prepare for that with economic aid that can quickly snap into place if it happens, if it needs to happen, so there's much less disruption than this time. In a city-state of 5.7 million people in an area the size of Indianapolis, Singapore has had 140 people dedicated to contact tracing, working in conjunction with the police. A month ago, it could test 2,000 people each day. That's the equivalent of testing about 115,000 people in the U.S. We were barely testing a tenth of that amount then. Singapore has always provided free testing and medical care to all of its citizens. More recently, it distributed reusable face masks to everyone. Officials were careful. While stores and restaurants were open, people were told to keep at a distance from one another, and gatherings of more than 10 people were considered inadvisable. All this is to say that people in Singapore have been operating in an environment that looks like what we might hope to create as we reopen, with safeguards beyond what we are probably going to achieve, and yet Singapore is in lockdown now. It's not clear how tolerant the United States would be of another national pause. If Americans fail to comply, the results could be disastrous. Preventing a second lockdown could even be considered a long-term investment. Our trajectory right now does not give me hope, said Greg Gonzalez, a professor of epidemiology and law at Yale. Social distancing is happening in only a patchwork across the United States. The next phase needs a massive national mobilization not seen since World War II, with dramatic scale-up of the production of tests for the virus and its antibodies. The commodities we need to do these tests, from long-stem swabs to RNA extraction kits and the personal protective equipment to keep those conducting the tests safe, we also need a huge new cadre of people to do these tests, trained and deployed across the country. And that's the first step, he added. All this sounds expensive, but consider that the cost of a shutdown is trillions of dollars. We clearly don't want to do this again. As Mr. Romer says, if it costs a couple hundred billion to avoid it, that may still be a relatively low price to pay. Okay, and this just in, the phrase go big or go home will now be go big and go home. Okay, let's dig a little deeper into the testing issue with a couple articles here. First, this from CNN. Prominent scientists have bad news for the White House about coronavirus antibody tests. In a phone call last week, some of the nation's top scientists briefed White House officials about antibody testing, according to two doctors who were on the call. Much of the news wasn't very good. Antibody tests check to see if a person has previously been infected with COVID-19, an indication that they've had the virus and now could be immune to it. What are antibody tests and what do they mean for the coronavirus pandemic? Dr. Deborah Birx, the coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, has called such tests critical. The test can help determine if someone is immune to coronavirus, and that's going to be important when you think about getting people back in the workplace, according to Dr. Anthony Fauci, member of the task force. The antibody test says you are infected, and if you're feeling well, you're very likely recovered, Fauci said. As we look forward, as we get to the point of at least considering opening up the country, as it were, it's very important to appreciate and to understand how much that virus has penetrated society. Trump administration officials have promised that antibody tests are on the way. We've made great progress with the antibody testing. Fantastic progress, Trump said in a media briefing April 5th. 5 days later, Vice President Mike Pence said in a media briefing that, quote, very soon we will have an antibody test that Americans will be able to take to determine whether they've ever had the coronavirus. But on the April 6th phone call, members of the National Academy of Sciences Standing Committee on Emerging Infectious Diseases and the 21st Century Health Threats told members of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy there are issues with the availability and reliability of the antibody testing in the United States right now. In three words, work in progress, said Dr. David Relman, a member of the National Academy of Sciences Committee who was on the call. There are several layers of issues with the antibody tests. First, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration relaxed its rules, and now companies can sell antibody tests without submitting validation data that shows they actually work. The Association of Public Health Laboratories says that this has resulted in, quote, crappy tests flooding the market. It's like the Wild Wild West out there, or Wild East, said Association CEO Scott Becker, a reference to the fact that at least half the companies making the tests are in China. Becker said that in a conference call Tuesday that FDA Commissioner Dr. Stephen Hahn said antibody tests would undergo scientific review by the National Cancer Institute. There have been concerns that some of the tests might confuse the coronavirus causing the current pandemic with one of several coronaviruses that cause the common cold. Lots of tests confuse the two, Relman said. The tests would then end up telling people they had antibodies to the pandemic coronavirus when they didn't, and people might think they're immune when they're not. A few days after the phone call, the National Academy of Science scientists wrote a letter to the White House, frankly apprising him about the quality of the antibody tests. Results from antibody tests should be viewed as suspect until rigorous controls are performed and performance characteristics described, as antibody detection methods can vary considerably, and most so far have not described well-standardized controls. Second, there are good tests in the midst of bad ones, but they're not yet widely and easily available throughout the country. Third, it's not entirely clear that having antibodies to COVID-19 means that you truly have immunity and won't get the disease again. Well, I'll add to that article. I read a really interesting article modeling the possibilities for kind of the second wave in the next year, maybe two, of this viral pandemic. And the most interesting thing is it looked at two sister coronaviruses. And these two viruses circulate around in the human population and have for years. They cause about one-third of the common cold. Well, one of the reasons why they're so persistent is because when you're infected with them, that immunity wanes in less than a year, generally 10 or 11 months, and you are no longer immune. So these annual and multi-year cyclings, you don't build up herd immunity because basically the immunity wanes, and this is just a continued ongoing cycle, so it becomes endemic in the population, forever present. This we don't know, but that's a real question that needs to be answered about whether antibody testing is the so-called savior that we seem to be looking at it sometimes. Okay, well, this next article, I just think, is one of the best illustrations of a contrast between what I would call a public health approach and a healthcare or medical approach. This from Stat News. COVID-19 testing issues could sink plans to reopen the country. Might CT scans help? To safer relax the chokehold that policies to control COVID-19 have on the economy, most experts agree that the U.S. will need a four-pronged strategy: aggressive diagnostic and testing for the disease, isolation of known cases, tracing of their contacts, and quarantine of anyone who might have been exposed until they are clearly uninfected. Many public health officials have focused on the challenge of contact tracing, saying it will require, quote, an army of new workers. In fact, however, the reopening effort is in danger of failing spectacularly because the U.S. hasn't gotten the first and last steps right, which both rely on accurate diagnostic testing. The current swab tests for the novel coronavirus are missing up to 30% of infected people. In a scramble to fix that before it's too late, a growing number of doctors are calling for use of another method to detect COVID-19, one that would miss fewer cases than molecular testing of swabs does: chest CT scans. CT scans are far more expensive. Editorial note, like 10 times more expensive. They expose patients to a low dose of radiation, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and some medical groups recommend against them to diagnose COVID-19. But they were widely used in China to identify cases, and their reliability there is fueling growing interest in adding chest CT to the diagnostic arsenal in the U.S. The scans detect hazy, patchy, quote, ground glass white spots on the lung, a telltale sign of COVID-19. In one study of 1,014 patients published in the journal Radiology, scientists in China reported that a chest CT scan found 97% of COVID-19 infections. In comparison, the study found that 48% of patients who had negative results on the swab test, which detect the coronavirus's genome, in fact had the disease. Once you're a couple days into infection, chest CT scans don't miss, said an emergency medicine physician in Louisiana who asked not to be named, with the swab test missing 30 to 50% of cases. Physicians in China called for the diagnostic use of CT early in the outbreak there, and fever clinics set up in Wuhan and elsewhere began routinely using them. A positive result on the swab test is usually reliable. If you get a positive test result looking for the DNA of the virus with the current methods that we have, it's very likely to be a true positive, said Jana Broadhurst, an infectious disease doctor and director of the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit Clinical Laboratory at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. But if you get a negative test result, the chance that it is wrong is about 30%. Of every 100 symptomatic people who test negative for COVID-19, 30 are actually infected. The test misses them. The main reason is sample collection. The swab that's supposed to be pushed into the back of the nose, often painfully, and then curved down to the throat sometimes doesn't reach far enough or doesn't remain in place long enough to collect a decent sample. The swab can trigger violent coughing, making the technician or nurse taking the sample pull back too soon. We have a mantra in the lab, Broadhurst said, garbage in, garbage out. Because the fault is human rather than molecular, there's no technological fix. If tests are the first leg of an exit strategy, as the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security said in a plan released last weekend for reopening the U.S. economy, then incorrectly clearing 30% of those who are tested will doom any exit plan. They could be cleared to return to work when they're actually infectious, and even worse, those they encounter and potentially exposed to the virus would not be identified and quarantined. We cannot rely fully on the test to guide decisions crucial to reopening the economy, said Sandra Galea, a physician and epidemiologist who is the dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. The alarming rate of false negatives from molecular testing, as well as the often days-long wait to receive results, is driving more and more medical centers to adopt CT scans for COVID-19 testing. They include Mount Sinai in New York City and a growing number of physicians across the country. Last week, the Fleischner Society, an international group of chest radiologists, broke with the CDC and the American College of Radiology, which recommend against chest CT to diagnose COVID-19. Society concluded that, in fact, can be appropriate in some situations, including a pandemic. Every ER physician I know recognizes the power of these scans, said Joseph Fairman, an emergency medicine physician at hospitals in New Orleans area who does 2 or 3 chest CTs on suspected COVID-19 patients every shift. Aggressive disease identification would involve both swab tests and CT to ensure the highest sensitivity, missing the fewest possible cases. To be sure, chest CTs are no panacea. They too can miss COVID-19 case. Just 2/5 of the Diamond Princess passengers who had positive swab tests had lung opacities, researchers reported last month. There's evidence that a large fraction of COVID-19 patients have normal CTs, said radiologist Mark Hammer of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Using CT to screen patients would let a lot of people go who may be infectious. Absent more accurate COVID-19 tests of any kind, whether swabs or CT or a combination, states' tentative, quote, reopening plans will be inefficient at best and failures at worst. The many COVID-19 cases that swab tests miss, says BU's Galea, is why the proposed Massachusetts contact tracing plan I have seen will quarantine people for 14 days even if they test negative, a fortnight that someone could have been safely back at work and in the community if only a negative result on the molecular test were more credible. Like many others, however, Galea questions whether something as resource-intensive as CT scans can ever be an effective population-wide screener. He calls it implausible, but not impossible. The reason for cautious optimism is that 80 million CT scans were performed in the U.S. last year. The country has a lot of scanners, especially in outpatient settings, Jefferson's Lakhani said, and in urban and rural areas alike. It's not clear how many COVID-19 cases testing can safely miss without sinking reopening strategies that hinge on testing and contact tracing, said Hopkins' Crystal Watson, a co-author of the Reopening Roadmap. I think we need to find the vast majority of cases, she said. Based on the experience of South Korea, upward of 90%. False positives are going to be a problem and could definitely undermine reopening hopes. Okay, well, I think really the take-home for this, and again, the divide between a medical clinical point of view and a public health point of view, is that a CAT scan, by the time somebody comes into the hospital, they've had symptoms probably for days, and their disease is advancing, sure, a CT scan is going to allow you to do better diagnostics. But that's purely a clinical healthcare help. Really does nothing to help public health. Because by that time, you're so many days out from the point of original infection that going back and trying to do contact tracing is useless. Timeliness is a real key. And waiting for people to get severe symptoms to be hospitalized and get a CAT scan in order to get a positive test, frankly, is just ridiculous. Again, it's great from a healthcare perspective because it's nice to know for sure whether somebody has the infection. Although actually in hospitals, practicing universal precautions, is something that's not unusual. But of course, with a flu-like virus, that transmits, you know, airborne, you know, you only have so many negative pressure rooms and that type of thing. So to be able to differentiate is good. But again, from a public health testing and contact tracing point of view, it doesn't add anything to the game. Okay, so where are we actually at on the testing issue? The number of people tested actually went down in the last week at under 1 million tests per week. This is primarily due to supply chain issues with specialized swabs to test patients and basic reagents necessary to complete lab testing. Also, some laboratories are having personnel shortages due to, quote, being run like a business. With non-COVID-19 healthcare at much lower levels, laboratories as businesses have been forced to lay off staff, and this is creating additional bottlenecks. Plus, as a myriad of different lab companies roll out their own testing regimes, not all insurance companies will pay for their particular company's tests. So this, again, patchwork approach creates additional barriers to ramping up testing, even if you have the machinery that may not even be close to being enough. Okay, so how much testing do we need to get ahead of the virus and safely open up the country? Well, it depends on the methods chosen, but anywhere from several million tests per day to tens of millions of tests per day. We've only done about 3 million so far total. In other words, anywhere from tens to hundreds of times more tests than our current system is capable of performing. Okay, well, where are we today with contact tracing? If you look at the number of disease investigation specialists, the contact tracers from the CDC, nationally we have about 600. And the sexually transmitted infection tracers, the largest group in state and local health departments, there's about 1,600. So 600 in the CDC, 1,600 in state and local health departments. So how many do we need? Well, the former director of CDC says, how about 300,000? From the Washington Post, he's quoted as saying, in Wuhan, a city of 11 million, the Chinese had 9,000 health workers doing contact tracing. He estimates authorities would need roughly one contact tracer for every 4 cases in the United States. Another estimate, the Harvard School of Public Health recommends 100,000. If you translate these numbers to what we would need locally here in Lucas County, that would be something in the order of 150 to 500 total. So where are our current efforts around the country? Well, there's a rumored national plan from the CDC, but we ain't getting anything specific. Again, nothing measurable. San Francisco started off with 10 for the whole city. They're hoping to ramp up in the process of training 150. Massachusetts has come out with a plan to train 1,000 contact tracers. Utah has a plan to get 1,200 statewide. And the Toledo Lucas County, this is one of the responses that, of the questions that I did ask where they're at with this. And they said, our goal is to have at least 100 individuals available to do contact tracing. This group of individuals will be comprised of Toledo Lucas County Health Department staff, University of Toledo students, and Medical Reserve Corps volunteers. Those Medical Reserve Corps volunteers is an ongoing thing for disaster preparedness that's run by the state. Now, I don't know if the students and volunteers comprise a full-time equivalent, but that's their goal, is to get 100 or more locally here. Okay, the other question that I asked the Toledo Lucas County Health Department was, what's happening with that congressional $8 billion appropriation for a public health response that was supposed to include money for the state and local health departments? And sure enough, we've got notice that that money is coming, and it's $382,794 for the Toledo Lucas County Health Department. That sounds like a lot of money, but that turns out to be 75 cents per capita. Well, I think maybe we should have a county-wide Zoom meeting and each talk about how we're going to spend our 75 cents to stop this disease in its tracks. So the bottom line is, for this $8 billion appropriation for public health response, the support to state and local health departments is about $24 per capita, and about 3% of that $24 is actually making it to our local health department. So I assume some of the other stuff is going other places like the state health department, but we ain't necessarily seeing it on the ground here locally. Okay, well, one thing that we need in order to stop this epidemic is increased testing plus the identification of symptomatic presumed cases, since our testing is not completely good. So the Toledo Lucas County Health Department has started an online COVID-19 community survey which you can complete the information if you're experiencing symptoms, and it'll guide you through with the information, and you can then possibly be followed up by one of these contact tracers. So far, there are 145 individuals that have completed this COVID-19 community service survey, and contact tracings have been started. So this is 145 individuals with symptoms that have reported over the last couple of weeks since this has been going. And to put that in some perspective, there's over 600 tested positive. So it's only a very, very small amount of people relative to even the small amount that have been identified. We expect that there's multiples, many times more people than that 600 that are actually positive. But if you know somebody with symptoms, you can go to lucashealth.org, I think it is, and fill out the survey. You can find it online pretty easily. So the unfolding reality of this pandemic continues to show the challenges we are facing. And I just wanted to cover briefly here several articles that are get to the difficulty of what we are facing. CNN, people might be most infectious with coronavirus before they show symptoms, study suggests. People might be most infectious with the novel coronavirus before they show symptoms, according to a study published Wednesday. The research published in the journal Nature Medicine adds to a growing body of evidence showing that seemingly healthy people are spreading the virus. We observe the highest viral load in throat swabs at the time of symptom onset and inferred that infectiousness peaked on or before symptom onset, the researchers wrote. They found that viral shedding, when people may be able to infect others, could begin 2 to 3 days before symptoms appeared. The amount of virus given off, though, appeared to decline after the people began feeling sick. Researchers gave a stark warning alongside their research. Because people may be spreading the virus before they show symptoms, public health interventions such as contact tracing will need to be adjusted accordingly. Not only will investigators need to identify those who are exposed to symptomatic people, but they may also need to look retroactively, tracing contacts from when people still felt healthy. Infected people without symptoms might be driving the spread of coronavirus more than we realized. More inclusive criteria for contact tracing to capture potential transmission events 2 to 3 days before symptom onset should be urgently considered for effective control of the outbreak, the researchers wrote. Okay, and from the Daily Beast, why do Italians test positive after symptoms are long gone? Italian newscaster Alessandro Politi was shocked when he tested positive for COVID-19 on March 11th. He and other colleagues were swabbed out of an abundance of caution after a co-worker contracted the virus. The 30-year-old has slight fever and a sore throat, but none of the chest tightness or other nightmarish symptoms so many suffered. Following the Italian Health Institute guidelines for releasing someone from self-isolation, Politi was tested again 2 weeks after his positive swab. But fever-free and with no symptoms at all, he tested positive once more. The test was carried out a week later, 21 days after his diagnosis, and he still tested positive for the virus. Now, 30 days later, Politi has just tested positive again, calling into question just how long the novel coronavirus stays in some people's systems and whether that might play a role in why, despite a month-long draconian lockdown, Italy just can't seem to shake the virus. Politi's case and a study of others involving people with mild or no symptoms who continued to test positive long after the 2-week standard quarantine ended has prompted the northern region of Lombardy to rethink its quarantine guidelines, and there are potentially profound implications for any country, including the United States, searching for a way to end economy-crushing lockdowns. Starting this week, anyone in the region of Lombardy who tests positive or who displays symptoms and is told to self-isolate in lieu of a swab must now self-isolate for 28 days, twice the CDC and World Health Organization recommendation of 2 weeks. Politi is not an isolated case. We need to understand how to act to avoid the worst. Taking millions of swabs is impossible, but countermeasures and solutions must be found, like, because patients like Politi, completely asymptomatic or not very symptomatic but fully positive after many days, are a problem. Okay. This from ZDNet.com. NYU scientists, largest U.S. study of COVID-19 finds obesity the single biggest chronic factor in New York City's hospitalizations. Now, one of the largest studies conducted of COVID-19 infection in the U.S. has found that obesity of patients was the single biggest factor after age in which the COVID-19 had to be admitted to a hospital. It is the largest case series from the United States to date. Bear in mind that age still functions as the biggest single overall determinant. Age is far and away the strongest risk factor for hospitalization, dwarfing the importance of obesity. Obesity is the most important of the chronic conditions when considering all such conditions simultaneously. The huge burden of obesity and other chronic conditions among Americans puts most of us at direct risk, they wrote. In fact, with obesity rates in the U.S. much higher than affected countries like South Korea and China, our outcomes, economic and health-wise, could be much worse. Okay, last episode, I had a stack of articles in the queue to cover that fleshed out how health inequities, more specifically racial disparities, are driving this pandemic. But I hit an hour and had to stop. These were articles with titles like How Coronavirus is Deepening American Inequality, COVID-19 in Ohio Hitting African Americans Hardest, Black America Must Wake Up to This Viral Threat, and Why Some People of Color Say They Won't Wear Homemade Masks. I promise I will get into this in my continuing coverage of this pandemic, but for now, I just want to lift this up as demonstrative of a fundamental fact in public health. Inequities and disparities drive virtually every cause of death, disease, and injury in the world. This is why I call this show Just for the Health of It, because justice is at the heart and at the foundation of an appropriate public health response. In case you haven't noticed, social distancing is a privilege. In our country, healthcare is a privilege. Racism, sexism, and systematic neglect of the most vulnerable populations is the norm. Look at the poor. We don't need to get back to normal. We need to fix so-called normal. We need to raise the bar. We need to break generational long cycles of injustice. Well, on that note, I'd like to end with a little more upbeat perspective and some final good news. Pollution is in fact decreasing with the slowdown of economic activity, and this feedback is good. It helps with lung problems. And one last appeal. Hey, are you an essential worker? If not, do you want to be? Well, you can donate blood. It's still needed, as always. Okay, well, that does it for my show today. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me at wakt@toppun.com. You can review this show or previous shows or queue up future shows by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. And I've added a new one this week. You can now find the show has a Facebook page. You can go to facebook.com/justforhealthWAKT, where the 4 is a number 4, not spelled out. Just for Health, WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some time.